all familiar with the idea of the ostrich burying its head in the sand, right? Troubles of lurking around, danger. They just pop their head down in the sand and pretend like everything is fine, oblivious to the world around them, right? What if I told you that's not actually true? That is a commonly held belief that ostriches bury their heads in the sand, but the reality is that these majestic creatures don't actually do that when they are afraid. Rather, what appears to be them burying their head in the sand, and I think that that picture is probably Photoshopped, by the way, because if you were to look at them from a different angle, what you'd actually see is that they're tending to their eggs. They don't have a nest that they construct out of twigs and branches and things like that. They bury their eggs just below the surface of the sand. And so what looks like them burying their head in the sand is them actually going down in there and turning their eggs and checking on their eggs and checking on their young. Despite that being the reality, though, the misconception nevertheless has persisted and has given rise to idioms like he's burying his head in the sand to describe somebody who is ignoring or at least trying to remain oblivious to the problems in his life or otherwise trying to avoid the problems that are swirling around him. And I'm sure if you're like me, you probably at some point in your life have felt much like that. You've wanted to just kind of ignore your problems that are cropping up. And if you haven't experienced that yet in your life, you will. Sooner or later, all of us are confronted by a problem, often a problem of our own making. And we just wish that we could shrink away into the background and hide under a rock or something like that. And just not deal with it. Just maybe hoping that it'll just magically resolve itself and go away without us ever actually having to confront it or do anything about it. Of course, that's not going to happen. You know, problems don't just magically resolve themselves without any effort. And so that's not a realistic possibility to just hide from our problems. That's not really an option for us. But that begs the question, what do we do? And when I think about that, I'm reminded of an event in the life of the scribe priest Ezra when he had returned from Babylon to Jerusalem. And that's why I want to spend just a few minutes this morning looking at these events in his life and see areas where we might be able to relate to him or some of the other individuals in this account and what we can learn from that about confronting similar circumstances in our life today. So let's look at the experience of Ezra as it's recorded for us in Ezra chapter 7 through 10. We're not going to read all of this text together, but I am going to read several chunks of it and make some comments about it so that we kind of all are on the same page and have a grasp of what is going on. I want to just say that at the beginning of Ezra's story, things are going great for Ezra. And that is primarily because the hand of God was with him. I think at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least 6 times throughout chapters 7 and 8, it mentions the fact that God's hand is with Ezra in the things that he is doing. We're introduced to him in verse 1 of chapter 7. It says, "Now after these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, there went up Ezra," and it gives a list of his genealogy, tracing it all the way back to Aaron, the high priest. But this Ezra, verse 6, "he went up from Babylon, and he was a scribe, skilled in the law of Moses, which the Lord God of Israel had given, and the king granted him all he requested." Why? "Because the hand of the Lord his God was upon him." Verse 7, "Some of the sons of Israel and some of the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants went up to Jerusalem in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes. He came to Jerusalem in the 5th month, which was in the 7th year of the king. For on the first of the first month, he began to go up from Babylon. And on the first of the 5th month, he came to Jerusalem because the good hand of his God was upon him. For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to practice it and to teach his statutes and his ordinances in Israel." So right here at the beginning, we see God's hand is with Ezra in this event. And then the ensuing text is going to elucidate more in depth how God's hand was with Ezra. We realize that Ezra is being sent on a mission by King Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, the king of all the world, to go back to Jerusalem to do some things here. And Artaxerxes writes this very nice letter commending the work that Ezra is getting ready to do, that he is commissioning Ezra to do. Read some of it with me, beginning in verse 11. This is the copy of the decree which King Artaxerxes gave to Ezra the priest, the scribe, who has learned in the words of the commandments of the Lord and his statutes to Israel. Here's the letter. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of God of heaven, perfect peace. And now I've issued a decree that any of the people of Israel and their priests and the Levites in my kingdom who are willing to go to Jerusalem, they may go with you. For as much as you are sent by me, the king, and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your hand, to bring the silver and the gold which the king and his counselors have freely offered to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, with all the silver and the gold which you find in the whole province of Babylon, along with the freewill offering of the people and of the priests who offered willingly for the house of their God, which is in Jerusalem. With this money, therefore, you shall diligently buy bulls, rams, and lambs with their grain offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them on the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. Whatever seems good to you and to your brothers to do with the rest of the silver and the gold, you may do according to the will of your God. Use the utensils which are given to you for the service of the house of your God. Deliver in full before the God of Jerusalem. The rest of the needs of the house of your God, for which you may have occasion to provide, provide for it from the royal treasury. I, King Artaxerxes, issue a decree to all the treasurers who are in the province beyond the river, that whatever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of God of heaven, may require of you, it shall be done diligently. Whatever is commanded, or even up to 100 talents of silver, verse 22, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt is needed. Whatever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be done with zeal for the house of God, for the house of the God of heaven, so that there will not be wrath against the kingdom of the king and his sons. We also inform you that it is not allowed to impose tax or tribute or toll on any of the priests, Levites, singers, doorkeepers, Nethinim, or servants of the house of God. You, Ezra, according to the wisdom of your God, which is in your hand, appoint magistrates and judges, that they may judge all the people who are in the province beyond the river, even all those who know the laws of your God, and you may teach anyone who is ignorant of them. Moreover, whoever will not observe the law of your God and the law of the king, let judgment be executed upon him strictly, whether for death or for punishment or for confiscation of goods or for imprisonment. I think about that for a second. This is an awesome mission that Ezra is being sent on by a worldly king, a pagan, and yet he is commissioning Ezra to go back to Jerusalem to make sure that the people there, the remnant who have returned, are worshiping God according to God's law. And not only does he want Ezra to go back and make sure that people are actually following God the way that he has commanded and instructed them to do, but he's saying, I'm going to totally finance anything and everything you need to go along with that work. All of the worship that's going to happen in the temple, that's coming from the king's treasury. I'm giving this generous gift. You're going to carry it with you. And if that's not enough, you have authority to take it from the treasuries of the king. I mean, that's pretty awesome. And then he's saying, I also want you to appoint other people in this area to make sure that everybody is actually carrying out the law of God. And so the only way I can imagine that a worldly pagan king would give this kind of authority to a man of God for this particular type of a mission is because the God of heaven is behind it. And indeed, that's what Ezra concludes in verse 27. He says, blessed be the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put such a thing as this in the king's heart to adorn the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem, and has extended loving kindness to me before the king and his counselors and before all the king's mighty princes. Thus I was strengthened according to the hand of the Lord my God upon me, and I gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. And so he gathers all the people that want to go, and he heads out to go towards Jerusalem. And so you have the king's letter, you have the king's bountiful gift, which is outlined in verses 24 through 30. We're not going to read all that. You can read how much the king sent with them, and they count it all up before they leave, so that way when they get there, they can count it again and make sure everything is accounted for. And they have pretty good, I almost said luck, on their travel. Ezra refuses to accept a military escort from the king, even though they're going to travel nearly 900 miles from Babylon all the way around. This is all desert down here, all the way around to Jerusalem. Now, as the crow flies, it will be about 500 miles from Babylon to Jerusalem. But again, you can't cut across the desert. They have to travel up around the civilized area. But that means they're traveling through places where people who might not like them are living. You would think having an armed guard with you would be a good thing to have. But Ezra doesn't want this. In verse 22 of Ezra chapter 8, it says, start in verse 21, he says, "I proclaimed a fast at the river Ahava that we might humble ourselves before our God to seek from him a safe journey for us, our little ones, and all of our possessions." And there's probably about 2,000 people, by the way, traveling with Ezra in this group back to Jerusalem. But he says, "I was ashamed to request from the king troops and horsemen to protect us from the enemy on the way, because we had said to the king, 'The hand of our God is favorably disposed to all those who seek him, but his power and his anger is against all those who forsake him.' So we fasted and we sought our God concerning this matter, and he listened to our entreaty." And not only does God protect them on this journey, this long journey, but they make this 900-mile trek of nearly 2,000 people in less than 4 months. And they're traveling by foot, okay? And so they're making great time on this journey as well. And all of that is because God's hand is favorably disposed to them. There is one minor hiccup that Ezra experiences in this whole process. And that is when they gather at Ahava, he looks around the people and counts them and realizes we don't have enough Levites here. And we read about that in verse 15 of chapter 8. He says, "I assembled them at the river that runs to Ahava, where we camped for 3 days, and I observed the people and the priests, and I didn't find any Levites there. So I sent for Eleazar, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jerob, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshulam, leading men, and for Joriab and Elnathan, teachers, and I sent them to Iddo, the leading man at the place Casaphia, and I told them what they were to say to Iddo and to his brothers, the temple servants at the place Casaphia, that is, to bring ministers to us for the house of our God." And notice this. This was a successful mission. "According to the good hand of our God upon us, they brought us a man of insight of the sons of Mahli, the sons of Levi, the son of Israel, namely Sherebiah and his sons and brothers, 18 men, and a bunch of other guys, all numbering 220 of the temple servants whom David the princes had given for the service of the Levites, all of them designated by name." So even this one little hiccup is quickly resolve because God's hand is favorably upon them. They make the journey. They return to Jerusalem. Ezra is carrying out the work. They're offering up sacrifices there at the temple. Verse 35, "The exiles who had come from captivity offered burnt offerings to the God of Israel, 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 lambs, 12 male goats for a sin offering, all as a burnt offering to the Lord. And they delivered the king's edicts to the king's satraps and to the governors in the provinces beyond the river. And they supported the people and the house of God." Everything is going exactly according to plan. Everything's going great because God is with him. But then things take a turn. And in chapter 9, Ezra is informed about a problem that exists among those who have returned and are living in Jerusalem. It says in verse 1, "Now when these things had been completed, the princes approached me, saying, 'The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the land according to the abominations, those of the Canaanite and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Egyptians and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has intermingled with the peoples of the land. Indeed, the hands of the princes and the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness." Now, to us, we might look at that and think that's no big deal. Marry people that aren't of your, say, nationality or country. But for the Jews, that was a huge deal. When God originally gave them the promised land, the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and all of those people, they were sent in there because those people were so wicked, they were to utterly destroy them. And God forbade his people from intermarrying with any of them. And of course, we know the history. They went into the land, but they didn't totally annihilate all of those people. And so some of those people persisted. And they were a thorn in Israel's side. And they carried them away into idolatry, which ultimately led to their captivity. And now that they've returned from captivity, what have they done? They've once again intermingled with those idolatrous people, even marrying them. And they're in danger of being drawn away from God once again. And so this is a huge deal. And Ezra's response, we might look at it and think this is disproportional to what's going on. But I would suggest to you that this is a proportional response to the problem that exists that he's just been made aware of. Verse 3, when I heard about this matter, I tore my garment and my robe, and I pulled some of the hair from my head and from my beard, and I sat down appalled. And then everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel on account of the unfaithfulness of the exiles gathered to me, and I sat appalled until the evening offering. I mean, Ezra is distraught over this situation that he's just been made aware of. I get this, he just kind of collapses on the ground, right? He tears his robes, he's pulling the hair out of his head, he is so frustrated, he's so upset, he's so distraught, and he's just now in a heap on the ground, and he's just sitting there. And people are gathering around him, and he's just sitting there. And it says that he sat there until the evening offering. The way I picture it in my mind, if I could put myself in Ezra's shoes, is he's sitting there and he's just kind of zoned out. He's blank and he's like a man who wants to climb under a rock and disappear until this storm passes. And yes, he does pray here to God, but I want you to notice in his prayer that his prayer is not a hopeful prayer. His prayer is not a prayer of, let's get to work and get this thing fixed. His prayer is a prayer of humiliation, a prayer of distress, a prayer of bleakness as he looks at the circumstances around him. Verse 5, at evening offering, I rose from my humiliation, even with my garment and my robe torn, and I fell on my knees and I stretched out my hands to the Lord my God, and I said, oh my God, I am ashamed and embarrassed to lift up my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen above our heads and our guilt has grown even to the heavens. Since the days of our fathers to this day, we have been in great guilt, and on account of our iniquities, we, our kings and our priests, have been given into the hands of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, and to plunder, and open shame as it is this day. But now, for a brief moment, grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us an escaped remnant and to give us a peg in this holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and grant us a little reviving in our bondage. For we are slaves. Yet in our bondage, our God has not forsaken us, but he's extended loving kindness to us in the sight of the kings of Persia to give us reviving, to raise up the house of our God, to restore its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. Now, our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you have commanded by your servants, the prophets, saying, the land which you are entering to possess is an unclean land, with the uncleanness of the peoples of the land, with their abominations which have filled it from end to end, and with their impurity. So now do not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters to your sons, and never seek their peace or their prosperity. That's what you said, that you may be strong and eat the good things of the land and leave it as an inheritance to your sons forever. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and our great guilt, since you, our God, have requited us less than our iniquities deserve and have given us an escaped remnant as this, shall we again break your commandments and intermarry with the peoples who commit these abominations? Would you not be angry with us to the point of destruction until there is no remnant nor anyone who escapes? O Lord God of Israel, you are righteous. For we have been left an escaped remnant as it is this day. Behold, we are before you in our guilt, for no one can stand before you because of this. I mean, here's a guy that's just like, oh my God, we have ruined it. You gave us a chance, and we screwed it up. There's no hope. What can we do? I see a guy whose heart is breaking. He's defeated. He's just laying there now. Chapter 10 and verse 1. Now while Ezra was praying and making confession, weeping and prostrating himself before the house of God, a very large assembly, men and women and children gathered to him from Israel. The people wept bitterly. You know, he finishes this prayer and he's just there in a heap on the ground crying. What to do? Thank God for someone who comes up to him, probably puts his hand on his shoulder as he's weeping, and calls Ezra to lead. Verse 2 of chapter 10. Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, said to Ezra, "We have been unfaithful to our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So now let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our Lord, and let it be done according to the law. Arise, for this matter is your responsibility, but we will be with you. Be courageous and act." Shechaniah tells him to get up and lead, reminding him that it is his responsibility as a priest, as a scribe. It's his responsibility to lead here. He doesn't really have a choice about it. Ezra, you can't just sit there and cry about it. You've got to get up and show us what to do. We can't hide from the problem. We have to take action. And Ezra, we need you to lead us in that effort. And as the rest of this account unfolds, I want you to realize that there are some other roles that are being played here besides that of just the leader, Ezra. The first is that which we've already looked at in Shechaniah. He is what I call the supporter. Shechaniah, he doesn't lead, at least not directly, though he does lead here. He does lead by taking his stand with the one who's responsible to lead, by taking his stand with Ezra, and offering his support and his commitment to follow the godly leadership that he knows Ezra can provide. He says, "Ezra, this is your responsibility. You've got to lead us in doing what's right, but I will be with you. Let's get to work together." And so he supports Ezra. And really, Shechaniah is the one who gets the ball rolling in a positive direction here. Not by handling it all on his own. Not by saying, "Well, Ezra, you failed. Everybody listen to me." No, but by saying, "Ezra, you know what we need to do. Stop crying about it, man. Let's get up and let's do it. And I'll be right there with you." He shows people and leads people by going to the one who can show them what to do. And in verse 5, it says that Ezra rose and made the leading priests and the Levites and all Israel make an oath that they would do according to this proposal. So they took the oath. And this proposal is, I think, what Shechaniah had said. "Listen, we sinned. Let's make a covenant with God. Let's put away our foreign wives as the law commands us to do, but let's do it the right way." And Ezra gets up and he says, "All right, let's all promise that we're going to actually do that. And they agree. And so you have some willing followers here as well among the leading priests and the Levites. But notice it's all Israel, because in verse 6 it says, Ezra rose from before the house of God and he went to the chamber of Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib. And although he went there, he did not eat bread or drink water, for he was mourning over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. But they made a proclamation throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the exiles that they should assemble at Jerusalem, and that whoever would not come within 3 days, according to the council of the leaders and the elders, all his possessions should be forfeited and he himself excluded from the assembly of the exiles. And so the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within 3 days. It doesn't say it explicitly here in the text, but the idea is that you have some of these leaders under Ezra. They've agreed that we're going to fix this problem, but now we've got to gather everybody together to do that. Let's send messengers out to summon everybody. And those messengers go throughout all Judah and Benjamin, and they gather everybody together, and now they all gather in Jerusalem to hear what are we supposed to do. And this is where we run into a group of what I'll call reluctant followers. They're gathered there. It was the ninth month on the 20th of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and the heavy rain. Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, "You have been unfaithful and have married foreign wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore make confession to the Lord your God of your fathers and do his will and separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from your foreign wives." Then all the assembly replied with a loud voice, "That's right. As you have said, so it is our duty to do. Ezra, we're going to follow you, but..." Verse 13, "There are many people. It's the rainy season. We're not able to stand in the open, nor can the task be done in 1 or 2 days, for we have transgressed greatly in this matter. Let our leaders represent the whole assembly, and let all those in our cities who have married foreign wives come at appointed times together with the elders and the judges of each city until the fierce anger of our God on account of this matter has turned away from us." Ezra, you're right. We messed up. We need to fix this. But not today. It's going to take too long. Why don't you get a better plan of how to organize things, and let's do it in an orderly manner. We can each come one by one and take care of it as long as it takes until the whole thing is resolved. And so you've got some followers, but they're kind of the drag their feet kind of followers. I know that's what we need to do, but let's kind of put it off just a little bit. Let's do it in a different way than what you've just commanded us to do it, which was just to make confession and do it on our own. Let's go with a different plan. And then you have a group of what I call the naysayers, those who don't want to go along with it. We read about them in verse 15. "Only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Josiah, the son of Tikva, opposed this, along with Meshulam and Shabbatai, the Levite, supporting them." So you got four guys that are like, "Nope, I don't want to do that." So you've got the guy who's supposed to lead. You've got the supporters, you've got the willing followers, you've got the reluctant followers who are dragging their feet, and then you've got the naysayers. But despite this, Ezra and the people overcome the impediments. The obstacles that they face, whether that's the reluctance of some or the refusal of others, it didn't stop the group from doing what needed to be done and moving forward in a positive direction. We read in verse 16, "Despite those who opposed, the exiles did so. And Ezra the priest selected men who were heads of the fathers' households for each of their fathers' households, all of them by name. So they convened on the first day of the 10th month, investigated the matter. They finished investigating all the men who had married foreign wives on the first day of the first month." And so this is about a 3-month process. But they wrap it up and they figure out who all has married foreign wives. And now it's time to do what needed to be done when they were called on the carpet about it. And the good news is that the people don't put it off anymore. We read in verse 18, among the sons of the priests who had married foreign wives, they were found the sons of Jeshua, the sons of son of Jozadak and his brothers, Messiah, Eleazar, Jerob, Gedaliah. They pledged to put away their wives, and being guilty, they offered a ram of the flock for their offense. And so on and so forth for all the others that are listed there who had been guilty of this violation of God's law. They repented of that. They rectified the situation. And they made amends by offering sacrifices to God. All right, let's think about some lessons real quick that we could learn from this. Number one, if you find yourself in a position where you are responsible to lead, perhaps you are a husband, a father, or a mother. Perhaps you're a boss or a manager at work or a teacher at school or maybe a team captain or a coach. Well, you don't have the luxury of crying when things don't go well. If you are in a position where you are responsible to lead, you've got to get up and you've got to lead in a good direction. If you find yourself, though, not in a position where you're responsible to lead, but a position where you can lead, perhaps you're one of the members of a team, whether that's a sports team, or whether that's a team at work, or whether that is in the classroom, or in your home, or among a friend group, or even among a church family. If you are in a position where you can lead, then you should lead. And notice that you don't have to be burdened with the obligation to lead in order to lead. That is, you should never say to yourself, well, I could do something, but that ain't my responsibility. That ain't my job. Even though technically it may not be your job, that doesn't mean that you can't do what you can do. And that doesn't mean you have to be the guy who's out front leading all the time or calling all the shots. But maybe you can play a just as important supporting role like Shechaniah. Maybe you don't know exactly what to do. You don't know how to lead, but you know who does know how to lead and they're not doing it. You could go to that person and say, listen, man, we got to do something. You know what we should do. If you'll do it, I'll do it with you. You have no idea how encouraging that can be to somebody who's trying to lead but is scared because of whatever reason. Let me also say that when we do that, whether we step into that leadership role or a supporting role and we're trying to move the group in a positive direction, don't expect everything to go smoothly from go. Even when you do get up and lead, that doesn't mean that everybody is automatically going to follow. For example, if you are responsible for leading and you've been neglectful of your responsibility, that is, you haven't been leading or you've been leading poorly, and you make the determination, I'm going to lead in a more positive direction. Well, don't just expect that everybody that you're trying to lead is going to automatically go, oh, okay, well, now that you're doing what you're supposed to, I'm just going to automatically follow you. You may have to walk a little while down the road leading in a positive direction before those that you're trying to lead actually see your progress and say, hey, he's going in the right way. Let's follow him. Or let's follow her. But sometimes it takes that one or two or three to take that kind of scary step out there. And it takes them doing that a little bit for others to finally catch on and say, okay, it's working. Let's follow along. There may be some naysayers who, despite what you do, don't want to go along simply because they don't like the direction that you're trying to lead them in. And there may be some who push back on what you're trying to do in leadership. They say, yeah, I know that we need to do this, but do we have to do it now? I mean, why don't you come back to us once you have a better plan formulated on how we're going to do this? Work out all the fine details, and once you get the plan refined, then come to us and we'll go along with you. Those things may happen. But if they do, when they do, we can't give up whenever we're met with resistance. We must continue to lead and move ourselves in a positive direction, a direction that draws us and those who are seeking to lead closer to God and closer to His plans for us. So, the next time you find yourself in a difficult, unpleasant situation, you feel like you and the group that you're a part of is moving in the wrong direction, what do? Don't be the ostrich who buries your head in the sand and just hopes it'll get better. Step up and lead in a positive direction. Don't wait for someone else to fix the problem. Don't just hope that it'll go away on its own. Get up and get busy walking towards a positive solution yourself. And don't be discouraged if there are some who choose not to come along with you, at least not at first, or those who keep working in the opposite direction. You need to keep working towards what you know is right and what you know is good, putting your trust in God, that those who have good hearts will follow a godly direction. And if you can't be the one who leads out front, then I want to encourage you to throw all of your support behind the one or the ones who can lead. There is a compounding effect when you follow the lead of another. And that is true both in a good sense and in a negative sense. The more the bad leader gets a posse behind him, the easier it is to go in a negative direction. But the more people that will start doing good and walking in a positive direction, the easier it will be for everybody to work in a positive direction. So make sure that you are contributing not to the problem by who you follow, but to the solution. And even if you meet some obstacles along the way, some who may be dragging their feet, some who are trying to confound the issue, keep pressing on, striving towards the goal. I got to share this quote with you from Rocky Balboa. And I will read it to you, but I promise not to try to do my Rocky Balboa impersonation. But it's in the movie where he's an old man and he's going to fight now again, a young buck. And he's having this conversation with his son who's complaining about his life and all this kind of stuff. He gives this great motivational speech to his son. I want to read just a part of it to you. This is what he says to him. He says, "Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place. And I don't care how tough you are. It'll beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done." And I would say to you, when you're in a situation that may be difficult, remember that just because there is a problem, that doesn't mean that the world is coming to an end. Even if the problem was caused by you, something that either you did or something that you failed to do, that doesn't mean that you are a failure. The only real failure would be to remain on the ground, beaten down and defeated. But if you will get back up and try to lead in a positive direction, that is a victory. That's how you win. That's how you succeed. That's how you lead. Will you be a leader this morning?